The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Some of you, not even another dollar, there are 95 million Americans who want to work, who are looking for work, in most cases, and who can't find work because there are no jobs. Don't believe for a minute the job statistics released by this corrupt criminal government. They're lies. 95 million Americans out of work. So for those of you who have a job and may not like it, for goodness sakes, protect that job and keep it, because if you lose it, maybe a long time for another one. Okay, 21 hours have passed since we last talked. We're going to bring you up to speed this hour on a story that has been pretty well kicked aside by the horrors in the mainstream media and the alternative media, from politics to war to mass murder, you name it. It's all grim. And what we're going to talk about this first hour with Dr. Henry Nyman, Ph.D., is the current status of Zika and what's going on here in these formerly United States with Zika. And I guess the first question for Henry is Henry, Zika now endemic in the United States? Is it now a permanent resident? We do spend a lot of time, you and I post stories, and you talk about travelers who go abroad and become infected and bring it back. It's not so much a human-to-human transmitter, although it can be sexually transmitted. There may be other ways, we're not sure. But this issue is one that is a slow burn. Total Zika cases in the United States, 953, and probably 96.7% of those are cases that were maybe 98. Were brought in here by people who went abroad into Zika-infested venues, got bitten, and came back. Some of the cases here, especially, we're beginning to see this, and I'm afraid it's going to become a tendency, people in South America who have become pregnant, rather than be careful, they know they're surrounded by Zika-carrying mosquitoes, they get pregnant, and they have a microcephalic child. The fetus is, what that means for you who may not know, is that the brain, the skull, is maybe half the size or even less in some cases. It's minimal compared to what it should be. These people, at least in one case it's documented now, these women have come up here with a microcephalic baby from a foreign country in Central or South America, drop the kid here. The kid immediately gets citizenship. As an anchor baby, and as an anchor baby, he is allowed to keep his parents and extended family and so forth. But the downside to that, or the flip side to that, is the simple fact that we pay for all the medical for this woman to have the child. We pay for all the medical that the child may require literally for the rest of its life. Now, I would suggest that this is not exactly fair to the American taxpayers, and that the country of origin should be responsible for taking care of its own citizens and any tragically microcephalic offspring that are born. Total to date in the United States cases, again, 953. That's it. We're not talking about tens and twenties of thousands of influenza cases which kill 40 or 50,000 people a year. We're talking about something different. And my question again, Henry, is Zika now endemic in these United States? And welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Well, Jeff, it's good to be back. And, to answer your question, to date, there really has not been a documented case of mosquito to human transmission of Zika in the U.S. And that's the reason the number is it's in the hundreds instead of in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. And the main reason for that is that it's the mosquito season just began a week or two ago, and there's a significant delay between the time a person would get infected and then get symptoms and then get confirmed and then have it reported. Uh-huh. So it's unlikely that there'll be reports of mosquito transmission until, maybe a month after it starts. And the official start of the mosquito season in most of the U.S. is Memorial Day weekend. And so it's only a week or two old. And there are some reports that are starting to show up in the news on West Nile virus cases. And that's an indication, because West Nile virus actually is on the same class as Zika. They're flaviviruses, and they're transmitted by mosquitoes. And so the first reports of West Nile is generally transmitted by a different species of mosquito, but that's an indicator that, there is going to be activity and there is going to be transmission. Uh-huh. And there's a couple models of that for the U.S., both with dengue as well as chikungunya. Both of those viruses are also flaviviruses, and they're also transmitted primarily by the Aegypti strain of mosquito. Uh-huh. And therefore, what's happened with those two infections in the past in the U.S. is somewhat of an indication of what may happen with Zika. And in fact, in 2010, I think there were over 100,000 dengue cases in southern Florida. And so you can kind of do some extrapolations on that to get an idea on what that could mean for Zika. But right. Unfortunately, there's another component to Zika. There's a couple different components to Zika, which raise concerns that it could be much worse than that. And that's why there's been as much concern as you may have seen as mm-hmm. far as
sure.
warnings for travelers and concern that things may change fairly dramatically. And just to give you an idea on those changes, some of the indications really started a month ago. And I don't know if you recall, but a month ago it was, the third Thursday of the month, and I was on and was telling you about the CDC weekly report on Zika. The CDC comes out with a report, it's officially on Wednesday, but it really doesn't become public until Thursday, and that kind of gives you a state-by-state tally of how many Zika cases there are. And they would also include how many cases of were sexually transmitted, how many cases were Guillain-Barre,
right.
and how many cases were from pregnant. And if you recall, a month ago I asked you, well, how many pregnant cases do you think were in the report that had just come out a few earlier before that?
As far as South America goes, yeah.
No, as far as the United States goes.
Okay.
How many pregnant Zika cases were there in the United States?
People who have come back.
Right. But, yeah, residents in the U.S. who have been Zika confirmed and were pregnant.
Right.
And that's updated each week in that report. And so I asked you if you... what the number was, and you said you didn't know, and I said I didn't know either. And the reason I didn't know is that was not included in the report. And that seemed a bit unusual because the number of pregnant cases in the U.S. is, in fact, the one of the key numbers. I mean, that's what the concern is, because that's where the microcephaly is going to be. And there are other reasons for that concern, to be concerned about pregnant cases. I'll get to that shortly. But the reason it wasn't in the report a month ago on the Thursday was that Friday they issued an early release MMWR. And they decided that they were going to make public how many cases they had in a registry, which they had mentioned previously. The CDC had said that they were going to keep a tally of all the pregnant cases in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and monitor those cases to see, you know, what the effect of, Zika infection would be on the child, both at birth, and they were going to follow the babies for at least a year to see if there were other, developmental problems. And when they announced it, the week before, there had been 48 cases. Their tally is usually a little bit behind mine. They basically base it on reports to, a central ARBONET that the states report them. And then the CDC basically puts that into their report. And I kind of keep a tally on what the states are putting up on their websites. And there's a little bit of a lag. But anyway, their number was 503 at the time, and was 48 pregnant. And then in the MMWR, they said, well, there's not really 48 pregnant in the U.S., but there's actually 157 pregnant in the U.S. And the reason that they had 100 more in the pregnancy registry than had been reported in their weekly reports was because if a pregnant patient was tested positive for Zika, but was asymptomatic, they didn't report it. And that was a concern for a number of reasons, one of which was that some of the retrospective studies in French Polynesia in particular, when Brazil started reporting the microcephaly cases, the question was, since the virus in the Americas is extremely closely related to the French Polynesia virus that was isolated from the outbreak in 2013-2014, they went back to see if there were microcephaly cases there. And they did come up with a small number. The island's pretty small, and they ended up with 8 that they had lab confirmed that they were had evidence of the virus.
What do they use on confirmation? PCR?
Well, there's two ways, and I was trying to get into that today.
Okay, yeah, whenever, sure.
A little bit, but well, there's a lot of confusion out there, and a lot of the confusion really has to do with the testing and what kind of tests are run. There's basically two different ways you can pick up the virus. You can do a PCR test. The limitation of the PCR test is that, at least in the past, it was typically done on a blood draw, and the virus is usually only detectable for like 2 to 7 days in the blood of an infected patient. And so, if you collect the sample too early or too late, you end up getting a negative, even though the person was infected. Now, it turns out that the virus is also detectable in urine, and in urine, it can generally be detected for up to 30 days. And then it's also detectable in semen, and there it may be detectable for a couple of months.
It might be many months. We don't know. It's kind of like Ebola. It hides out. Yeah.
Right. And it's also present in saliva. And it's still a little bit up in the air as to whether it can be, you know, transmitted.
Okay, may I ask a question? I wrote, edited one of the first books on HIV/AIDS in the early 90s. And one of the vectors that was acknowledged by a lot of people back then, including Dr. Robert Strecker, who really was a pioneer in researching HIV/AIDS back then, is that all body fluids were shown to contain live virus. Now, how many virions does it take to become infected? That was the question. But the potential for vectoring through wet kissing, through tears, through urine, through semen, all acknowledged. A virus is a virus is a virus, and this virus, Zika, like HIV and many other viruses, apparently finds a lot of different media in which to take up residence in the body.
That's correct. There are, you know, different means of transmission, and the sexual transmission, really through semen, both male to female and male to male, has been documented.
You know, Henry, if I might, one more thing, please. I argued that back then because people usually, when they have sexual relations, engage in wet kissing. Now, it was established then that blood transmission through saliva was a gimme. That was an easy one. And I suggested, and this was never denied, that a lot of the sexually transmitted HIV cases were being transmitted through wet kissing. It further was established that 50% of living humans have blood and blood products in their saliva at all times because of poor gum health. And if they brush their teeth or kiss passionately, the number of people showing blood and blood products in their saliva rises to over 90%.
Right. Well, I mean, you can pick up the virus without blood. So, I mean, it is in saliva.
Oh, understood. This doubles it up, though. That's my point.
Right. So, you know, that's harder to prove.
That's right.
But there is one case that actually was in France a few weeks ago, and that case did suggest that it may have been transmitted through kissing, because the contact in France who had not traveled did get infected, and there was no vaginal ejaculation, and so it was suspected that transmission might have been transmitted through kissing
orally. Yeah, sure. Yeah,
and that's probably the best example of that mode. Although, you know, you could come up with other means, but that it would have been high on the list. But so there are various ways that it can transmit. Although the dominant way is through the mosquito biting the human, and then to get it established, for instance, in the United States, that would involve a traveler who was infected coming to the United States and then getting bit by a mosquito, leading to the infection of that mosquito, and then that mosquito subsequently bites other humans and then infects those humans. And so that's the mechanism that really would spread the virus fairly dramatically. And that has been documented in part because it really isn't mosquito season yet. So of the cases that you mentioned, the 940, 53, is actually a little bit of an underestimate, because what happened when they made this announcement a month ago, and all of a sudden there were an additional 100 cases. Some of the states went and revealed how many of those cases were in those states. And Florida was one example where they had previously reported 9 pregnant cases. And then they said, well, they had 27 more. So they really had 36 pregnant cases, not just 9. And the reason, and the discrepancy was that they weren't reporting cases that were asymptomatic. And part of the reason the CDC did start to report these cases that were asymptomatic was because when those studies were done in French Polynesia, and they identified women who had babies with microcephaly, they asked whether they had, some of these symptoms. And the symptoms, one of the symptoms that is fairly easy to recognize, but it's not in 100% of the cases, is just a rash, which can quickly spread and be a full body rash. It only lasts a few days, but it's an itchy rash, and it's fairly obvious. There's also conjunctivitis, and there's bone aches and and fever. Several of these women did not report any symptoms. They indicated that they could recall having any of those symptoms during their pregnancy, and that raised the distinct possibility that the microcephaly happened in women who were asymptomatic. And therefore, the women that were in this registry but not being disclosed very well may end up giving birth to babies with microcephaly, because in those cases, they were lab confirmed. And then the other group that was in the registry that weren't being reported were ones that weren't definitely just Zika, that they would have. And this comes in the testing. Because of the limitations of the PCR testing, and women that were pregnant, but they may have been asymptomatic, or they certainly weren't symptomatic at the time that they came in for testing, because the testing got expanded because it was clear that there could be asymptomatic. And so any pregnant woman that had traveled to one of the areas where Zika was transmitting locally was encouraged to come in and get tested. Okay. And the other way to test is with an antibody test. And so the antibody test, the more sensitive one is a neutralization test, where they measure antibodies in the patient's blood that can actually bind to the virus and keep the virus from growing. Uh-huh. And the problem with that neutralization test is that it requires live virus. And as a result, at least at the beginning, that was only done at the CDC. And so there was a bit of a backlog. But then the other disadvantage of that test was the fact that the antibodies that were generated by an infection would cross-react. And so if you were infected with dengue, you could get some activity against Zika and vice versa. And same thing for chikungunya and even yellow fever. If you had been given a yellow fever vaccine, you could have generated antibodies against the yellow fever virus, which would also cross-react. And therefore, there were cases that were designated as inconclusive, where they had activity against Zika, but they had activity against at least one other flavivirus.
Okay. Hold on. Hold that thought, Henry. I'm late for a break here. I got to do this.
Okay.
We'll come back in just a couple minutes with Henry Nyman. Okay, let's get right back to Henry and our update on Zika virus. All right, Henry.
Okay, so the other cases that were in this registry were ones that were designated as inconclusive. And the inconclusive could be due to cross-reactivity, and it also could be due to a dual infection, because the other two viruses, the chikungunya and the dengue, are fairly common in countries in South America or the Caribbean or Central America. And they're carried by the same Aegypti species, and therefore it's possible that people actually do get infected with two or more of the viruses. And so they could have antibodies to the cross-react, not just because they had one infection with an antibody that recognized the other virus, but they may have actually been infected with two different viruses, and therefore they made antibodies to both of them, and that's why it was inconclusive. And so it didn't really matter if a woman was infected with Zika plus chikungunya or dengue. The problem is that the Zika is neurotropic, and the virus would be able to find its way to the fetus and cause the problems with microcephaly or potentially other neurological problems, even if she was infected with another virus. And exactly the effects are pretty much unknown. So part of the reason for the registry was to basically identify these cases, know what type of lab results they got, and then follow the pregnancies to find out, what kind of problems were associated with the Zika activity. So the registry is a good idea. The problem with the registry, though, is the CDC was kind of not real forthcoming about any of the details. And so I kind of keep a map to both get an idea of where the virus is coming from as well as where the cases are, and in the not-too-distribution future where the mosquitoes are that are affected. And one of the key ingredients are the pregnant cases. And unfortunately, the CDC just gives an aggregate number each week. And it really causes confusion on getting an actual total. So the number that you were citing that I sent you with the 953, the number of cases is actually higher than that, because it doesn't include these pregnant cases that haven't been reported by the states. And that's a bit of a fuzzy number, because what happened is when they made that announcement, a few of the states, like Florida and Texas, actually did come out and say how many cases they had in the registry that they had not been reporting previously.
Right.
Most of the states, however, kind of ignored that. And so exactly how many cases there are in those states that are pregnant, mm-hmm. that didn't meet the original definition, which was that they were pregnant, they were Zika confirmed, and it was conclusively shown that they had Zika and only Zika, and they had symptoms. The other, you know, less definitive, but not necessarily less important, especially those who were Zika positive, were not included. And so that 951.53 is actually an underestimate, because the number of pregnant cases now is up to 234. And so some of those 234 are not included in that that number, because those are the ones that have actually been assigned to each of the states. And those numbers are actually a couple hundred higher than the number that the CDC has reported, because the CDC goes through this ARBONET, which has a lag of several weeks. So in any event, there's really over 1,000 cases that have been lab confirmed. Now the problem is twofold. And one is that a lot of people don't get tested. And they don't get tested either because A, they're not pregnant, or B, they're not symptomatic. And especially they're not symptomatic or pregnant. And so those cases still offer a reservoir. They still brought the virus into the U.S. They still could, you know, potentially infect a partner through sexual transmission. But more importantly, the mosquitoes don't really care whether the person's been tested or not, or reported or not.
They
represent a source. Now, the other problem has to do with the pregnant cases. So the pregnant cases are obviously a problem to the fetus, because the mother can infect the fetus, and then the virus can go to the brain of the fetus. And lead to microcephaly, particularly if the baby's infected in the first trimester or the beginning of the second trimester. But that creates, in addition to creating a problem for the fetus, the pregnant women also create a much expanded reservoir for the mosquitoes, because, you know, as I said, it exactly what it takes to get for a mosquito to get infected, there's not a lot of hard data on that, but the mosquito gets infected by, you know, actually drinking the blood from the human that's infected. And, you know, if you just kind of, as a ballpark figure, the mosquitoes can get infected if the human has detectable levels in the serum, then most people will only lead to mosquitoes get infected for a few days after they return from their travels, if they haven't been infected locally. But the problem with the pregnant women is that the virus goes to the baby's brain, and there's so much virus that's made in the baby that there's spillage of that virus back into the mother's serum. And so with a PCR test, virus can be detected in the serum of women for months after they were infected, because there's so much virus in the fetus. And so that would represent a reservoir for mosquitoes getting infected by infecting the pregnant women. So that may be an accelerator in the case of Zika that really isn't present in the case of dengue or chikungunya. So if the virus gets going and ends up infecting enough people, including pregnant women, which are a bigger reservoir than non-pregnant, then it's possible that the spread could be more dramatic than it's been seen before for these other two viruses.
I got an email question for you.
Okay.
Since we're talking about the virus being apparently present in virtually all body fluids, if someone had conjunctivitis, for example, and they're rubbing their eyes a lot and got the virus on their hands, there's a potential. We don't know how volatile the virus is, what the viral load has to be before someone will cross a threshold and become infected. But that's another potential. If you were to get it on your hands or put your hands in your mouth, for example, in other words, wash your hands. Conjunctivitis is another possible.
Right, right. So, there are theoretically a bunch of ways that it could transmit, but the numbers, for instance, like in Brazil, where there are millions of people infected,
right?
There's a good association between the number of people that are infected and the number of mosquitoes. And that kind of brings us to one of the other questions that has come up in the last month, and that is, the issue of the Olympics and whether they should be canceled or, what that risk is and could that end up creating a major epidemic. And those questions have been bandied about a little bit. They've been kind of, WHO has come down with their answer. And I thought I'd just touch on, how they got their answer and why the answer they came up with was going to be fairly obvious. And why it probably was pretty much overblown as far as the risk is concerned. And that's just based upon what the numbers are of people that are flying in and out of countries where the virus is being transmitted locally. So countries that already have the virus in the mosquitoes and where people flying in can get bit and bring the virus back to their country of origin, I think the number is somewhere between 20 and 25 million people annually go to those countries. And the number of people that are expected to go to the Olympics is about 500,000. And so those two numbers kind of gives you an idea of what kind of increased risk there is by people flying in for the Olympics. That the 500,000 is a pretty small number next to the 20 million. So the virus is going to be spread by 20 million at about the same rate as the virus being spread by 20.5 million. There's 500,000 people going to Brazil are not going to basically appreciably increase the number of people that are going to have potential exposure. And then the other part of that equation is, the transmission scheme is that to get infected, the vast majority of people that would get infected by going to the Olympics would get infected by a mosquito. And Rio in particular, is in the southern hemisphere. And so the Olympics in August are actually in the dead of winter for Brazil. And August really has the lowest temperature. It isn't that low. It's still in the 70s.
Right.
But it's the lowest temperature, the month with the lowest temperature for the year. And it's also the month with the driest in the year. And so both heat and moisture are really what drives the reproduction of the virus. The mosquitoes don't live that long and they don't fly that far. And especially the Aegypti, they generally only fly like hundreds of feet away from where they're born. So they really don't travel long distances. And they need the moisture, to hatch. And so when it's dry and when it's cooler, there really aren't that many mosquitoes. And in August, for instance, you know, it may be safer to go down to Rio than it would be to go to Miami, especially if the virus starts to take off in the next month or two. By August, that is generally when it's peak season, both for mosquitoes as well as transmission. So the idea that holding the Olympics in August in Rio is going to be a major contributor to the spread of Zika.
I would think, yeah. Kind of like we thought that on a small scale, like we thought Hajj was going to be.
Right. Well, Hajj is a little bit different simply because you do have a lot more people going. I mean, in the case of Hajj and MERS, it is in the Middle East, and it is primarily in Saudi Arabia. And the number of people that actually come during Hajj is a significant number compared to how many people are actually in Saudi Arabia or actually leaving Saudi Arabia for other time periods. So it's so in that case, that ratio would be quite a bit different, that the Hajj would have a good number of people coming into Saudi Arabia would come for that event versus
right.
Zika, because Zika is not that concentrated in Brazil anymore. That's part of the reason I did this map, that the vast majority of the cases that are in the United States, which has got, you know, the most reported cases, you know, that doesn't have local transmission yet anyway, the cases are largely coming from Central America and the Caribbean, or the northern part of South America, like Colombia or Venezuela.
Right.
There are very, very, very few cases that are actually coming from Brazil. And so Zika is no longer concentrated in Brazil. The Zika, you know, the big burst of cases did start in Brazil in the spring of 2015. And then there was about a 6-month lag before it started to take off in other countries. And that 6-month lag is important. The other part of this story is what is going to happen with the microcephaly. And what the sequence of events really creates a lot of confusion, and the reason it creates the confusion is that most of the microcephaly cases come from infections in the first trimester, the beginning of the second trimester.
Yeah. By the way, if I might, Henry, let me just run. People don't know what microcephaly is unless they look it up. Babies with microcephaly can have a wide range of problems, very serious problems. The baby's head is half the size in many cases. The skull, the brain hasn't developed properly during pregnancy. That's retarded. Or the brain has started to develop correctly, but then was damaged at some point during pregnancy. The child can have seizures, developmental delays. It can be have speech problems. Intellectual disability, decreased ability to learn and function in daily life, problems with movement and balance, feeding problems, hearing loss, vision problems. The child can be grievously damaged, all right? Just keep that in mind. Go ahead.
Right. And that's the microcephaly is the potential problem that is easily recognized. Unfortunately, the effect of Zika infections in the second and third trimester on many of these, endpoints that you just mentioned is not well known. You know, it's very possible
right.
that the infection in the second or third trimester will result in all kinds of problems as the child gets a little bit older, but it's not going to be very apparent at birth. Whereas the microcephaly and other neurological issues with regard to hearing and vision are things that can be tested, you know, very early and can be identified as a problem. So the microcephaly is the big red flag that says, well, Zika is going to cause a problem. But the microcephaly is largely limited to the first trimester, beginning of second trimester. So the women that do get infected in the third trimester or most of the second trimester do not give birth to babies with microcephaly. And so what happens is when Zika, you know, starts to transmit locally and the number of cases start to explode, the first babies that are born to women who are confirmed to have been infected with Zika are babies that were infected in the third trimester. And the government says, oh, it's not a problem here. We've got all these women that are Zika infected, they're pregnant, and the babies, you know, look perfectly healthy. And they count that, and they're going to say, no microcephaly here. And that gives rise to all these other stories, you know, that, well, this was a Brazil problem, and it has to do with the mosquitoes and the GMOs, or it has to do with a virucide, or it has to do with some type of vaccination. And this is Brazil, and it's not going to be an issue in the other countries. And the reason for that is because of this delay. So they say, well, we've had all these babies who were born in Colombia, none of them have microcephaly. There's something going on in Brazil that's causing this problem, and it doesn't have anything to do with the virus. But that's because of this delay before the microcephaly appears. And then, since the countries don't want to admit that they've got microcephaly and it is a problem and they've been giving these false assurances for 6 months, then they won't report the microcephaly until they've actually got lab confirmation. And the problem with lab confirmation is that by the time the baby is born, the virus is generally cleared. So if they test the baby for the virus,
got it. Yeah.
The baby will be negative, the mother will be negative, and they'll say, well, the baby's got microcephaly, but it's not from the virus. Now there is a test that can be done, and that's to look at the cerebral spinal fluid of the newborn.
Right.
And that's an antibody test. But the antibody test is like I said, it is dependent upon neutralization, and it requires live virus, and it requires, you know, an invasive procedure to get a cerebral spinal fluid.
Not fun.
And so it's many of the cases just aren't tested at that level. Now, the alternative is to do a radiological examination, like an MRI of the baby's brain, and a lot of these problems that are associated with a Zika infection do show up with characteristic changes in the MRI. There'll be these calcium deposits, which basically are there because the virus infected the brain and literally ate holes in the brain. And so instead of having brain tissue, there's just salts. There's just calcium deposits. And those show up in the MRI as these little white circles. And then there's different changes in different anatomical conditions that can be seen on the MRI. And so radiologically, it's fairly easy to make the diagnosis that this microcephaly was due to some type of infection. And then there are a few other types of infections that can cause microcephaly that can be tested for, called TORCH and,
All right. We're just about out of time here. Wrap it up in 30 seconds if you can. Where are we and where do you think we're going to go?
Well, I think things are going to change extremely dramatically. Today, the U.S. just announced that there are actually six cases in the U.S. There are three live births, and there are three more that terminated. And so they just started. Today, it was announced that they're going to keep a tally on how many U.S. cases. El Salvador just announced its first case.
Huh.
And it turned out that this was a baby that was born in April. And so all of these countries that do have microcephaly cases have basically kept them under wraps. And so there's just going to be announcement after announcement on how many countries have a large number of microcephaly cases, including the U.S.
Okay.
And now mosquito season is starting. And so the next announcement will be in the next, might take a month, but it's probably happening today, is that there is local transmission in the U.S. And so the local transmission in the U.S., coupled with a steady stream of microcephaly cases, is going to create some significant issues in the next month or two.
Sounds like it. Thank you, Henry. A superb overview, as always. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay, very good.
All right. You too. Okay, we'll be back with hour two in just a few.